Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here is Bob.
49:7 deals with Edom. And on your outline, I've done a job of trying to define some of these words for you and where they come from and parallel passages and who they are and all that. So if you'll follow with me through this, we won't be reading every scripture passage because we're still in a section that is really a condemnation of the nations surrounding the promised land and those nations that had something to do with God's people. So Edom, as you know, is a word that means red. If you've ever been to Israel, you'll know that when you go down the Arabah, on the left-hand side heading south, there's a range of reddish mountains on the other side from Israel. It's about 100 miles long, and that's where Edom is, and it comes from the red of those mountains. He's one of the descendants of Esau, and by the New Testament time, this same area became known as Edomea, and this is where Herod the Great was from. They were subdued and forcibly circumcised during the Maccabean period, and so he became to be a leader through intrigue. This area was also known in the Bible as Seir, and I have the references there for you, Genesis 32:3, Numbers 24:18. A Jewish scribe of the Middle Ages, not a middle-aged Jewish scribe, says that this word refers to Rome. Now, this word Edom did later come to refer to Rome, but it's much, much later, and it doesn't fit anywhere in the context, so I think kimchi is just a little bit off in this particular area. You notice in verse 7, well, before I do that, this is one of the few racial groups that Israel is commanded to be kind to. Deuteronomy 23:7-8. But there was really some bad blood between these folks. And I've listed there on your outline all those passages where Israel and Edom really had some struggles together. And so there was a lot of animosity between these two groups of people. The whole book of Obadiah is a reaction to the Edomites, as well as those, all the rest of those passages. Now, you see the word Teman? That's a grandson of Esau. We find that from Genesis 36:11. It seems here to be either a city or a tribal location. And as you know, many of these tribes and localities were named after ancestors from the book of Genesis. You see another one down there in verse 8, Dedan. It's an oasis in northwestern Arabia, but it's also a descendant of Ham. We find from Genesis 10:7 and Genesis 25:3. Rashi, which is another Jewish commentator of the Middle Ages, thinks that it means valley and not a city at all. But it really looks like it's a city when you read the context. There's many other cities mentioned. It looks like that's what it is. But there's a whole lot of confusion because of these words through here. Now, verses 9 and 10 are really almost exact the words of Obadiah, verses 5 and 6. One of the strange things about Jeremiah, and the reason I'm not going to read it verse by verse, there is a lot of repetition through here, not only inside Jeremiah, but from other parts of the Bible. When we get to chapter 50, we're going to find the Septuagint doesn't even list the prophet Jeremiah as the author of all these. It seems to be a combination of a lot of poetry about these different nations put together. And it seems very disjointed to us as we read through it. But notice in verse 10, it mentions the word Esau. And Esau, of course, is the Hebrew word hairy. If you remember the story, he's the one that his hands were like goat hair. And just like sometimes all the people of God are called by what ancestral name? Jacob. Jacob stands for all the Jewish people. So Esau stands for all of Edom, and that's why that name appears here. When it mentions, I have uncovered his hiding places, Edom, like Moab, is a very, very mountainous area. If you'll turn the back of your Bibles to your map and find the section that will show the Dead Sea, you'll find Edom and Moab to the southeast of the Dead Sea. And if it's a relief map, you'll see how mountainous the area really is. Because of that, they were very proud of their fortifications. They had some very strongly fortified cities and fortresses. But God says they will come down. Notice in verse 11 where it mentions the widows and the orphans. This really reflects the book of Deuteronomy. It's one of the highlights of Deuteronomy that God is extremely concerned about those people in society who are forgotten by the mainstream. And it's reflected here. And verse 12, a very unusual little phrase, who were not sentenced to drink the cup will certainly drink it. Now, this is repeated through here at least four times, five times maybe, this reference to the cup of the Lord. Now, the first time I really became interested in this is when I was preaching on Mark 14:36, where Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane says, "Let this cup pass from me." And I really began to wonder, what cup is he talking about? And I guess the best reference for me in the Old Testament is Psalms 75, verse 8, which speaks about, oftentimes the word cup means a man's destiny. But more often than not, it means judgment. And here it is that Jesus is drinking the cup of judgment for all men. And you'll see all the verses. It's in Psalm 60, verse 3, Isaiah 51:17, Ezekiel 23:31-34, and then I put Mark 14:36. So it's a way of talking about the cup of destruction. You might want to see chapter 25:15 in the book of Jeremiah, where this is mentioned again in the context of this book. Now, in verse 13, there's a city named there, Bozrah. That is the capital of Edom. It's the largest city. And then notice where it says, and all its cities will become perpetual ruins. Well, we know from history that what happened to this whole area is it was defeated by Nebuchadnezzar, and nomadic Arab tribes took over this whole area. There was no more settled cities. They were destroyed, and just nomadic settlements of camps instead of cities. And so this was pretty much literally fulfilled in the life of this people. Then in verse 14 through 16 is really another passage that comes from the book of Obadiah. Obadiah verses 1 through 4, almost exact to 14 through 16. Lucia, the other night you mentioned about the rose city of Petra. Well, there's a reference to it here in verse 16 where it mentions, O you who live in the clefts of the rock who occupy the height of the hill. They were very proud of that city. It was almost impregnable and could be very well defended militarily. But they lost their caravan route, and the city died. And nobody took it. It just died on the vine. And so I think it's probably referring to Petra when it mentions the rock here in Edom. Down in verse 18 is a reference to Sodom and Gomorrah with its neighbors. Now, of course, the two cities we're talking about is Adamah, which is Hebrew for earth, and Zeboiim, and both of these are mentioned in Genesis 18 and 19. And Deuteronomy 29, 23 through 25 is where these cities were mentioned. Modern archaeology, at least to my satisfaction, has pretty much found the location of these cities of the plains, as they're called. And they seem to be under the southern end of the Dead Sea. They have really been able to locate a lot of pottery from the period of this time at the bottom of the Dead Sea. And that seems to be the location of Sodom and Gomorrah and Adamah and Zeboiim. Now, in verse 19, God is speaking. And you'll notice he's going to use many metaphors through here. A lot of shepherding metaphors, a lot of agricultural metaphors, a lot of animal metaphors. This passage is strewn with them. And here he's mentioning, who is like me and who will summon me to court? And who then is the shepherd who can stand against me? And it's just God finally saying, look, I'm in charge here, folks. You know, I really am in charge of history. And I'll do what I want to, thank you. It's almost Romans 9 from an Old Testament perspective. Then in verse 21 is something that I don't know if you've been exposed to before, but you see the last part of verse 21 where it says the Red Sea. If you have a New American Standard and you'll notice your margin, it has a different translation there. It has the Sea of Reeds or Yam Suf. Now, I think the Sea of Reeds is an accurate translation because I don't believe the children of Israel crossed the Red Sea. I think they crossed the marshy inland waters of the Mediterranean almost to the coastland, up toward the mouth of the Nile. And if you look at the map in the back of your Bible, if you look at the route of the Exodus, you'll still see the inland waterways are drawn in, which by our day are filled now. But they were marshy areas instead of a great expanse of water. It was a marshy area. And every time in Hebrew it says, in your Bible, the Red Sea, every time in the Hebrew Bible it's the Sea of Reeds, every time. And I think that's probably the route the Exodus followed. Okay, if we come into verse 23, we're going to be dealing with a series of cities here. Three cities that cover the whole geographical range of Syria. Damascus is listed first because it's the capital city of Syria. It's one of the most beautiful cities in the whole Middle East. The other two cities that are mentioned in the second line of verse 23, the first one is in central Syria, and the second one is in northern Syria. Now, all of these fell under Tiglath-Pileser III. Now, wouldn't that be a good name for your grandkids? Old Tiglath-Pileser. Well, he was an Assyrian monarch, and these towns fell, Damascus in 732 B.C., and the other two in 738 B.C. So they were pretty much destroyed relatively early as far as independence. Now, when it mentions the next to last little phrase in verse 23, I have New American Standard. It says, there is anxiety by the sea. But if you have any of the translation, you know how radically different it is. The Hebrew is very, very difficult here. There are as many different translations of this as there are translations of the Bible. And I really don't know what it's referring to or really what it means. The book of Amos deals some with Damascus and her fall in Amos 1, 3 through 5. That may be some help to get the big picture. Down in verse 27, and as you can see, I'm just skipping through here because you can read this and get the idea. I just want to help you with the difficult or unusual phrases. Notice Ben-Hadad. Now, in Semitic languages, the word Ben means son. So Ben-Hadad is son of Hadad, and Hadad is the storm god of this particular people, and it's analogous to the Baal of the Canaanite religions. And so this is kind of like Pharaoh. A lot of rulers are named Ben-Hadad in Syria. And like Pharaohs stand for king, son of Ra. This stands for son of Hadad. Okay? Verse 28 is another division now. And we're going to be talking about the Arab tribes concerning Kedar. This is also a descendant from the book of Genesis, a descendant of Ishmael in Genesis 25:13. These apparently are Bedouin tribes that are characterized by black tents. You see any of those, Lucia? And they live east of Palestine across the Jordan River. And they were a nomadic Bedouin tribe. Now, if you look, there's several words in this little phrase here that are interesting. I've listed for you in your outline all the places in the Bible that this name Kedar appears. It's mentioned quite often through the Bible. Now, you see where it says the kingdoms of Hazor? Well, that word kingdoms, I think, should better be translated chieftains. And the word Hazor is not the famous city of Hazor in northern Galilee, is the Jewish city. But this word with just a slight vowel change, not consonant change, vowel change, can mean unwalled villages. And that really fits the context better. Because we don't know where a second Hazor is, but we are talking about nomadic Arab tribes to the east of the Jordan River. And unwalled villages fits much, much better in the context. And I really think that's what we're talking about here. And then it says, which Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, defeated. Historically, this defeat came in 599 B.C. You might want to write that in. Another group of nomadic people are mentioned in the last part of verse 28 where it says, and devastate the men of the east, or the sons of the east. Now that is another nomadic group of people. We find that from the book of Judges, chapter 6, verse 3. For this particular group, the men of the east, are identified with the Midianite tribes and the Amalekite tribes. And so it's another nomadic Arab group. You can tell that by the rest of this section if you just took a time to read it. Look at verse 29, it's mentioned tents and flocks. Then down in verse 31 it says their cities have no bars and no gates, obviously nomadic. And then down in verse 32 it says, those who cut the corners. Now look at your Bible. I don't know what translation you have, but you see where it says, of their hair is in italics. It's slanted slightly. Now that means it's not in the Hebrew or the Septuagint, but it's supplied for an English reader to try to get you to understand what the translators think it means. Now if anybody here has New English Bible, New English Bible, anybody? New English Bible translates this, not those who cut the corners of their beards, which is the Arabs, but they translate it on the fringes of the desert, which is just as good a translation. And I can see how that fits, couldn't you? These Arab tribes on the fringe of the desert. But let's take for convenience that we are talking about the Arabs that trim their mustaches. Now, if you remember back in Leviticus 19:27, it says that the Hebrews are not to trim their beards. One way you can tell in Israel today, a Jew from an Arab, is the shape of their beards. Now, why is that? Well, there's three possibilities. There's several scriptures. Jeremiah 9:26 and Jeremiah 25:23 also talk about this. Number one, it appears to be a pagan mourning rite for the dead. Number two, it seems that the hair of people's face was involved in divination and magic. And number three, we have historical evidence that many people cut their beards in certain shapes, or their hair in certain shapes, in the honor of this deity or that deity. And so there's something of that in this cutting the corners of their beard, in which it is, I'm just not real sure which one of those it is. Now then in verse 33, it mentions the heart of jackals, a desolation forever. Now, these are some of those words that I mentioned to you that the more we have archaeological discoveries in cognate Semitic languages like Ugaritic and Sanskrit and all of that, the more we're finding that these words are titles of demons in other societies. And they were translated like this in English because we didn't know what they meant. But ostriches and all those other things we're going to find in chapter 51 are really names of foreign gods and foreign demons. And I think that fits much better. Now, when it says, look at the last part of verse 33, nor will a son of man reside in it. Here is one of the uses of the term son of man in the same fashion as the book of Ezekiel. Now, I believe that one reason that Jesus chose this term, Son of Man, is because it's used in the book of Ezekiel and twice here in Jeremiah, the other place is 51:43, to simply be a way of saying human being. But it's also used in Daniel 7:13 about someone likened to the Son of Man riding on the clouds of heaven, which is the transportation of deity. So here is a term that was not used in rabbinical Judaism of the first century. It has the connotation of humanity and the connotation of deity. Now, can you think of a better title for Jesus to use to himself than a term that had no nationalistic, militaristic, first century Jewish connotations, but also had the connotation of humanity and deity caught up in it? I think it's an excellent term for him to use for himself. And here it is used simply as human being. Now, in verse 34 through 39 is the country of Elam. Now, Elam is 700 miles east of Jerusalem. It is clear on the other side of the Tigris-Euphrates River Valley. Now, it was a very, very important, powerful empire in the early days. Matter of fact, Genesis 14, 1 through 11, tells how they made raids over all this whole part of the area. And Elam is also a descendant of, and I have it somewhere, Do I have it in your notes? Son of Shem, isn't he? Genesis 10:22. Now this little, the word in Akkadian means highland. Okay? So it's east of Babylon. The capital of this land is Susa or Shushan. And both names apply to the same place. In modern day, if you listen to, remember back in the, when our focus of our news attention was on Iran, and they talked about the problem province of Kurdistan, the rebels, that is Elam, modern Iran, Kurdistan, plains of the Kurdistan. Okay, right, and so that's what this is. Now, it mentions here a date, a time date. It's the beginning of the reign of Zedekiah. So the date here is 597 B.C. By the way, just to give you a New Testament reference, on the day of Pentecost, Acts 2, verse 9, people from the country, they're called Elamites, were in Jerusalem and received the gospel. I think that's a beautiful expression of exactly what God says down in verse 39, when there's a spiritual promise of restoration to these people. Okay, I notice where it mentions the bow of Elam down in verse 35. Apparently, this group of people were very world famous for their archers, because they're mentioned in Isaiah chapter 22, verse 16 as being part of the Assyrian army that invaded Israel. And they're mentioned there. Now, in verse 36, where it mentions the four winds, the four winds are a common biblical metaphor for armies. And we see that several places in the Bible. Ezekiel 37:9, Daniel 8:8, Zechariah 6:1-8. These four winds are used as military images and metaphors. Verse 39 is very beautiful, I think, that God's going to restore these. I hope you have the outline with you I passed out last week that listed all of these nations from chapter 47 through 49 and the different characteristics of them. If you don't have that, if you'll see me after this session tonight, I'll get that for you. It's a very helpful overview of a rather disjointed series of chapters through here. Now, chapter 50 and 51 are going to deal with the judgment on the nation of Babylon. It's an extended work. It's somewhat disjointed, but it's a very important work, okay? Nebuchadnezzar is mentioned in this section two different times, chapter 50, verse 17, chapter 51, verse 34. Nebuchadnezzar died in 562 B.C. So I think the time of this writing, of this, whenever it was, is before 562. Now, if you look at the first part, you notice the name Chaldeans. Remember, Chaldeans in the Bible can refer to a racial group of people, the Babylonians, or it can refer to a group of magicians and wise men from Media. The Magi are also the Chaldeans. Daniel, in the book of Daniel, is identified with the group of the Chaldeans, not racially, but this group of wise men. Here, it seems to refer to the racial stock of the civilization in the Tigris-Euphrates River Valley. Now, you see where it says, through Jeremiah in verse 1, the Septuagint leaves that out. Now, a lot of folks say, well, why do you mention the Septuagint? The more we learn from the Dead Sea Scrolls, the more we're finding that the Septuagint is not a divergent translation of the Old Testament, but an alternate translation of the Old Testament as old as the Masoretic text. And so it's really very helpful sometimes, and not so helpful other times, to look at how it, and compare it. Now, if you'll notice verse 2, we're going to mention two different, down toward the end of the verse, we're going to mention two of the gods of Babylon, Baal and Marduk. Now, really, they came to mean the same god, but originally they were different. The word Baal is kind of a corrupt form of the Hebrew word Baal, or Lord, or Master, or Owner. And this was the god from the Sumerians, the storm god, Enlil, E-N-L-I-E, E-N-L-I-L. Now, they came to be identified with the Babylonian major god, Marduk, or, and I'll spell the other one, M-E-R-O-D-A-C-K, Merodach. Now, this is, have you ever read the Babylonian creation account, Gilgamesh epic? This is the creator god in the Babylonian pantheon, Marduk. And he becomes identified with this Baal later. And so the name really is a synonym to the time Jeremiah is writing. Okay? Notice down the last part of verse 2, it says idols. Now the word idols here, if you notice on your outline what I have translated it, Bright, which is an excellent translator, this word, the etymology of this word is to roll. And the Jews really like to make fun of the gods of other nations. They change the vowels and make them, like, instead of Melech, they make it Molech and all of that. Many of us think that what this word is dung balls. Now, you can imagine how a Jew would love to call the idols something like that. They kind of giggle when they say it. This word's used many times for idols, and I've listed them there in your outline, the number of places this word for idols is mentioned. And verse 3, it says, a nation has come up against her out of the north. Now, two things are happening. We've used the word north so often that it's almost become a metaphor for problems and trouble and war. But still, if you look at your map, if we're talking about Media, and that's the nation that's mentioned most in these two chapters, not Persia, not once, but Media, Media is directly north of Babylon. And so that's where the problem is going to come. And so I think it's a little more literal there than a metaphor, but it's becoming a metaphor for trouble from the north. Now, if you'll notice down in verse 6, it mentions their shepherds. Now, of course, remember the word shepherds in Jeremiah refers to political or religious leaders. And what it's saying is the shepherds, if you'll read the rest of verse 6, are taking them up, taking them aside, turn aside. Remember the Hebrew words for sin all mean to deviate from a standard. So to turn aside is a Hebrew way of saying to commit sin. And when it says on the mountains and then gone from mountain to hill, remember the high places of the Baal and Ashtaroth fertility cults were on the high points of the mountain. And so what it's saying is God's people's leaders, political and religious, are leading the people to commit idolatry. That's what it's talking about. Let's go down to verse 11. Notice it mentions through there, because you skip like a threshing heifer. You probably have something different than that. There is a million translations of this one. The Septuagint and the Revised Standard Version has a heifer at grass. The Peshitta has a fat heifer, and the Masoretic text has a threshing heifer. I think the picture here is that this nation, Babylon, is like a cow that is used for threshing the grain. But she's been released from her yoke, and now she's just wandering around the threshing floor, eating anything and everything in sight. And she's getting huge. There's Babylon. Rich, wealthy, lazy, ready to kill. And that's the picture. Now, in verse 12, it mentions your mother will be greatly ashamed. It seems we're talking about the city of Babylon here. Notice it says she will not be inhabited, then in verse 13, and she will be completely desolate. This was not literally fulfilled in Jeremiah's day because, as you remember, Cyrus did not destroy the city of Babylon. If you've read Daniel chapter 5 lately, they snuck in the city and captured Belshazzar by diverting the water from the Euphrates River and went under the wall and took him by surprise and didn't destroy the city. Only later did Darius destroy the walls and gates to make the city dependent. But later on, in our day, there is no inhabitants of the city of Babylon. It's in total desolation, even today. One of the archaeologists was commenting that when they were beginning to put their trenches down through this area, this tail, there was 80 feet of sand and debris on top of the ruins of Babylon. Now think how deep 80 feet of sand is. A lot of junk piled up on that place. You might want to see chapter 51, verse 26 for a parallel passage here. Now, skipping over to verse 16, it says, they will each turn back to his own people, and they will each flee to his own land. This is a reference to the farmers that Babylon was irrigated by a series of canals. And all the farmers that it took to keep this nation in food were exiles just like the Jews were. And as soon as this enemy from the north invaded, all of these subjugated peoples fled and went back to their own lands. Matter of fact, what Cyrus did to keep the people under control was to let them go back to their own land, gave them money to rebuild their temples, let them go back to their national identity, and that way assured his own reign. Okay. Verse 17, we mentioned both the king of Assyria and the king of Babylon. I want to mention again the king of Assyria that destroyed the northern 10 tribes of Israel is Sargon II, and the date is 722 B.C. I hope you'll write that down. Very important in the history of the Old Testament. 722 B.C., Assyria takes captive the northern 10 tribes, Israel. Now, the king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar III, in 586 B.C., takes into exile the southern 2 tribes of Judah and Benjamin. And that's how everybody got into exile for Persia to let them come back home in 538 at the decree of Cyrus. All right, and notice the word pardon down in verse 20. This is a unique Hebrew word that is only used for the forgiveness of God, never any other way. It's a very beautiful, special word in the Hebrew language, which speaks again about that God is going to forget and forgive and restore His people, and the people who have hurt them are going to pay a drastic price. Now, in verse 21, we have two names here, and I'm not sure how to pronounce those names. They are Babylonian names. And the first one there that starts with a Merathaim, I guess, or something like that, and the word Pekod or Pekod is, these are plays. These are word plays. Now, if you look in the margin of your Bible, if you have a reference Bible, you'll see the first one is often translated double rebellion and the second one punishment. Now, we know from Babylonian history that this first name is very similar to a district within Babylon in the southern region. So it may be a way of talking about southern Babylon. And the other one is a name of a province in eastern Babylon. So it's a play on words that here two major provinces of Babylon are going to be in double trouble and going to be under punishment. So it's a play on those words. Notice down in verse 21 it says, "Slay and utterly destroy them, declares the Lord." Remember when we went through Joshua verse by verse and we talked about holy war and the special Hebrew term for that called the harem, which means that everything that breathed in the city, including women and children and ducks and donkeys and everything, died. Well, that's the word here. It refers totally dedicated to God, which makes it too holy to live. It must be destroyed. And that's the word used there. This city fell 539 B.C. to Cyrus. Okay, Babylon. Now, notice there in verse 24 where it mentions, while you yourself were unaware, that kind of reminds me of Daniel chapter 5. Remember that whole account of the Tiglath-Pileser on the wall and Belshazzar's feast and all that? They were surprised. The whole city was caught off guard. Nobody expected it. And it seems to be an allusion to that kind of thing. Verse 26, it's an agricultural metaphor. All her grain is open in piles and come take what you want. And it's just a metaphors of destruction. Verse 29 to me is a very important verse. It says, "Repay her according to her work, according to all that she has done, so do to her." Man, that is a glaring Old Testament counterpoint of Galatians 6:7. "Be not deceived, God is not mocked. Whatsoever a man sows, that shall he reap." And that's true of nations. You see, the whole purpose through here is that though Babylon and Assyria were God's instruments of judgment on the nation of Israel, they were still responsible for their barbaric, godless acts. And though God used them, they're responsible. And exactly what they did to others were measured out to them. In our cultural word, we have a little phrase, if a man lives by the sword, he'll die by the sword. That's it right there. As they did it to others, God will do it to them. That's a pretty biblical truth, I think. Now, the last part of that, when it says, against the Holy One of Israel, does any of y'all know what prophet uses this name so much, the Holy One of Israel? This is Isaiah's word. Man, this is the only place it appears in the whole book of Jeremiah. But Isaiah uses it, and I think I listed for you all the places in Isaiah that it's used on your outline. Skip down to verse 34. We have the word Redeemer. The Lord of Hosts is His name. Now, the word Redeemer is the Hebrew word Goel. You remember in the book of Ruth where Boaz had to buy the right to marry Ruth? Well, this is the idea of a nearest relative buying back his relatives from slavery or redeeming their property or, you know. It's the picture of God. And we've seen God as husband. We've seen God as parent. And now we see God as closest relative. Beautiful picture. Down in verse 38 is another semantical problem. You see, it says a drought on her waters and they'll be dried up. Now, the word drought, and you may have the word sword. The Hebrews' letters are exactly the same. And remember, this was written with no consonants. The consonants, they were spoken, and all the Hebrew people knew what consonants went there, but they weren't recorded. It was a consonant-only language until the Masoretic scholars in the 9th century A.D. put the vowel points in. So whether it's sword or drought is uncertain, but I really think it's drought. Because, see, these system of canals, remember the Jews were exiled by one of these canals called the Kibar. It was a man-made canal where Ezekiel saw the wheels and all that, man-made irrigation ditch. And she kept her agriculture alive with these irrigation things. Well, for them to dry up meant things were over. And I think drought is probably a better word. Now, here in verse 39, we have these wild desert creatures again, jackals, ostriches. I think they're names for demons in the other cultures around them. The more we're finding Semitic languages, the more that's proving to be true. Verses 44 through 46 are repeated in Jeremiah 49, 19, and 20, which shows me we have a series of poems that were put together probably by Baruch. I'm not denying they're from Jeremiah, but I am denying that he spit this out all at the same time. I don't think he did. Now, let's move to chapter 51, if we could. And in verse 1, we see the name Leb Kamai or Kami. This is one of those code names for Babylon. Now, why it's used here, I don't know. Because he's mentioned Babylon several times. If this is a part of a poem that was used while Babylon was still in power, it's kind of like in the book of the Revelation, we don't say Rome. What do we call her in Revelation? What do we call Rome in the book of Revelation? Babylon. Yeah. Well, they're not saying Babylon, we're going to squash you like a bug. They're using these other names so Babylon won't know they're talking about her. Now, then in verse 5 is an interesting word. It says, for neither Israel nor Judah have been forsaken. But the Hebrew word there is the word widowed. And I think that's a beautiful picture that's saying God is still her husband. Now, she's played the fool and she's played the harlot and she's been punished, but she's not a widow. She's got a husband, a rightful husband, and he's going to bring her back home. Verse 11, I'm sorry I have to go so fast through here, but it's just too much to cover all this. And besides, it gets a little boring. Just you can read it. It's just God, sock it to him, thank you, smash. And you can read that on your own. In verse 11, it says, sharpen your arrows, fill your quivers. Does anybody have the American Standard Version here? ASV? It has the word shields instead of quivers. This is the only place in the Bible this word is translated quivers. Everywhere else, this word means shields. And so I really think it probably means shields. It's from the Akkadian root and not the Hebrew. The Lord has aroused the spirit of the kings of the Medes. Now, I want to make this Cyrus. Cyrus was such a... God even calls Cyrus my anointed, which means the same word for Messiah. Wow. I don't think Cyrus was a believer, but God mightily used this man to restore the Jews. Now, I want to say it's Cyrus, but why can't I say that? The word's plural, the kings of the Medes. And so it doesn't seem to fit. From archaeological evidence, we know that in 561 B.C., the Medes alone, not Medes and Persians, the Medes alone attacked Babylon. But we have no record of what happened, if they were successful or defeated. Now, Cyrus's mother was a Mede. And so maybe it's talking about the generation of kings after Cyrus. But isn't it funny that Media wasn't the big nation? Cyrus was of Persia, and he conquered the Medes first. But Persia is never listed through here. I really think the date of these writings is about 561, something like that. 560s, around there. Now, verses 15 through 19 are repeated verbatim in Jeremiah 10, 12 through 16. Why? I don't know. Verses 20 through 23 seem to be a little poem about the hammer of God that's placed in here, but it's speaking about Babylon. And it seems like it's a flashback to Babylon the mighty at one time, God's hammer, but now Babylon herself is going to be smashed. And that seems to be what it's talking about. And you can read 24 and 26 about she's a mountain, but she's going to be destroyed and burnt out and all that. Then in verse 27, it mentions lift up the signal in the land. That's a standard, and it's not a standard like you carry a flag in battle. But the ancients didn't have the communications we did. They'd get up on a hill. They didn't see any John Wayne movies, so they didn't have smoke signals. But they'd put a banner up on the top of the hill, a certain color. And that would tell the army what to do, to assemble or retreat or, you know. So that's what it means when it says a signal. And blow your horn, of course. For a Jew, it's the zophar or the ram's horn, which was a way to communicate to troops in battle what to do, as well as a ceremonial thing. And then it uses the word consecrate, which is the root form of the Hebrew word holy, kadosh, which means consecrate the nations. Now, the idea here is that all these nations that are going to attack Babylon are set apart for God's service, just like Babylon and Assyria were set apart for God's service in defeating the Jews and punishing them. Now these other nations are going to be consecrated to God to be the instrument against them. You see those four nations, Ariat and Mene and those are all in modern Armenia. And they are all part of the Persian army that overthrew Babylon. We find contingents of them in the historical records. If you'll look down through here quickly, it uses locusts as a metaphor for you here. It uses women in childbirth quite often through here. Then down in verse 31, it says, a courier runs to meet another. The ancient system of communication was runners. And they would run so many miles and pass the message on and run so many miles. Matter of fact, we get the word marathon from one of the battles in Greece where the runners were taking the message about the defeat. Marathon. That's where we get the English word from. So it's a system of couriers. Notice verse 34 is an interesting metaphor. It talks about Nebuchadnezzar ate too much. He gorged himself and then he threw it up. Terrific. But that's the metaphor. If you look at the last one of verse 34, it says, and he washed me away. Oh, that's a little mild. Vomit's the word here. And if you look down at verse 44, you'll see it used again, the same metaphor, that Baal, the god of Babylon, is going to have to throw up the Jews. Some people say this is where Jonah came from. I doubt that, seriously. Let me go back up here a bit. In verse 41, you see Shishak. This is another code name for Babylon. You might want to see chapter 25, verse 26 of Jeremiah. Notice the word in verse 42, the sea. Now, that is the word that is often, it's a mythological word in the Babylonian creation account. It's of one of the gods, Tiamat. And it's the god of chaos that Marduk defeats. So I think here, put back into Babylon, see the tumultuous waves and all that? I think that's probably what it's allusion to. See the word son of man again down in verse 43? In the last part of verse 44 it says, even the wall of Babylon has fallen down, an exclamation point in my Bible. Babylon was one of the most majestic, impenetrable looking cities in the world. It had two walls. The first wall was 12 feet thick. The second wall was 21 feet thick. Three chariots abreast with four horses each could go around the top of the major wall, the city of Babylon. 21 feet around the entire city with a canal in between they could divert the Euphrates into. Holy moly, what a city. What a powerful structure. It didn't work. Didn't hold up. Notice down in verse 46, the last thing says ruler against ruler. If you're familiar with that, with the history of the Babylonian rules, after Nebuchadnezzar died, his son took the throne. He was killed by his brother-in-law. His brother-in-law reigned a few months, and it was taken over by someone else. It was really a hodgepodge of intrigue right after the death of Nebuchadnezzar. It lasted 30 more years, but boy, it went downhill fast, and I think that's an allusion to that right there. In verse 49, it says, "Indeed, Babylon is to fall for the slain of Israel." Now, that's an interesting verse. Babylon's going to be defeated because of what she did to the people of God. This is a way of expressing the Old Testament deal of what? Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. You destroy me, I'll destroy you. And that's the logic here. Verse 50, the word, "Remember the Lord from afar off and let Jerusalem come to your mind." Remember in the Bible, the word remember usually refers to God's judgment. The word forget usually refers to forgiveness and pardon. Have you ever thought about that? When God remembers, it's bad news. When God forgets, it's good news. And I think you see that here. Over in verse 55 is an allusion again to that roaring waters, Tiamat. You might want to see verse 42. We may get through this thing after all. notice in verse 57 where it says, "Declares the king whose name is the Lord of hosts." Israel has always considered God to be her king. That's why it hurt Samuel so bad that Israel wanted a king. Let me give you a few references. Exodus 15, 18, Numbers 23, 21, 24, 7, and Deuteronomy 33, 5. The broad wall at verse 58 is mentioned again. By the way, the height